Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us for How She Does It. On this show, we talk about all things women, money, and power. I'm Karen Feinerman. Music is ever present in my life, from my morning exercise till right before bed. And we all have a soundtrack of our lives, songs that transport us to a moment or an era. One note and you're right back there. But music is also a multi-billion dollar business. So who runs this business? One of the most powerful, long-standing players in this business is our guest today. Jody Gerson is the CEO of Universal Music Publishing, the first woman ever to hold that position at a major music publisher, and she is chairwoman of its parent, Universal Music Group, again, a first at a major music company. Since joining Universal in 2015, Gerson has truly transformed the company, which has now surpassed $2 billion in revenue. Despite so many of the biggest performers being women, Taylor Swift, Alicia Keys, Billie Eilish, Lana Del Rey, the list goes on, the industry itself has long suffered from a lack of women and diversity, not only on the talent side, but also on the executive side. Jody has played a major role in making the industry more inclusive for women. She is also the co-founder with Alicia Keys of the global nonprofit She Is the Music, which uses, among other things, songwriting camps and mentorship programs and more to increase opportunity for women in the industry. I could go on and on about her, but let's just meet her instead. Jody, welcome.
Thank you, Karen.
So good to see you.
Thank you. So good to see you.
Okay, first off, just tell us the difference between music publishing and the music business. Where do they overlap?
So there's the music business, and then there's the record company, and there's the publishing company. It's two different royalty streams. I like to think of a record company as representing the artist, the master recording. So every time you hear a recording of, let's say, Lana Del Rey, the label, right, controls that recording. The underlying right in that recording is a song. And in the case of Lana Del Rey, Lana is the songwriter. Sometimes she has a collaborator, Jack Antonoff, who is also a songwriter with Lana. We represent Lana and Jack as songwriters. So I guess the easy way to think about it is every time you hear a song, no matter what version that song is, whether it's a cover version of a song, whether that song was in a film, TV show, whether it's streamed, wherever you hear that song, the underlying song had to be licensed and paid for. So if you're watching a television commercial and there's a Bee Gees song in that commercial, but Bee Gees aren't singing that song, we still, as the music publisher, represent the rights to that song, and that song has to be licensed and paid for. So that happens all around the world. And that really is what music publishing is. Just think about it. When I explain it to relatives and friends who don't know what I do, I just say every time you're in an elevator, you're in a dentist's office, you're in a doctor's office, you stream a song, you turn on the radio, you watch television and there's a commercial, that's music publishing. Every song has to be licensed and paid for, and royalties are collected all over the world.
Okay. So I understand that. All right. So it's interesting. We're catching you. We meet you now at this time. You are at the very pinnacle of this business. But tell us your backstory. Where did this all start?
So I grew up in Philadelphia. My father and grandfather were in the nightclub business. So when I was growing up, I used to sit ringside at, it was like, imagine a Las Vegas style nightclub. It was actually in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. We used to go across the bridge. So I grew up going and sitting with my family to see my father and my grandfather really every Sunday at the matinee shows. And I saw the greatest entertainers of that time, from Frank Sinatra to Diana Ross and the Supremes to the Temptations to Ray Charles to people like Richard Pryor, and every artist who played there for 7 days, including two shows on Sunday. So my mom would take us to sit and have dinner with my father and my grandfather every Sunday. So for me, I grew up watching great entertainers. I also have to say I was somewhat precocious and would watch the entertainer backstage as they were getting ready to go on stage. So not only did I sit in the audience and watch them perform, but I watch what happens behind the scenes. Some people threw up. Some people got nervous before. Some people practice their vocal cords. And so I think what that did for me was I started to really understand from a young age how artists feel, how artists think, the anxiety of an artist. And I really feel like that prepared me for this job. Now, when I graduated from college, did I set out to be a music publisher? I did not. I didn't know that music publishing was a career. So when I was growing up, because my father and my grandfather were in the nightclub business, it was a business where there was a lot of cash. It was pre-credit cards. So we felt rich. You know, I went to private school. I went to summer camp. I had everything I could ever want. But in 1979, they legalized gambling in Atlantic City and the nightclub closed. So my dad, who clearly didn't prepare for the future, when I went away to college, my second year at Northwestern, the tuition check bounced, which was in some ways shocking. Mm-hmm. But I have to tell you, Karen, my whole life, I was the grown-up in the family. My father was bigger than life personality, bigger than life. He was the center of entertainment in Philadelphia. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom. She was always there for us. She got an allowance from my father. And so there was something about growing up that from a young age, I always had a sense that somebody had to be the grown-up and it was going to be me. So when that happened at Northwestern, I got a job. I got a job first at a candy store in town, and then I got a job in a clothing store in Chicago. And when I look back on it, it was kind of the thing that changed me. And would I have been as ambitious if that hadn't happened? I'm not sure I would have, but I look back on it and I think that it taught me tremendous resilience. And I think that carried me through my career. As for the music part, it was the thing that I knew. And when I was growing up, I had internships at radio stations and television stations. And when I was at Northwestern, I was on the concert committee. And so when I graduated from college, I knew I could sell anything. I knew, just put me in the room, I could sell it. But what did that mean?
Where did that confidence come from that you could sell anything? I know you're a hard worker, but selling is a different kind of thing.
I've always credited my father and my grandfather for the confidence that I had. I still feel my grandfather pushing me on my back, pushing me forward to talk to people, pushing me. You know, and I had a dad who could walk into a restaurant and always knew what to order and was kind of a big shot. But when I look back on it, I feel like it was my mother who gave me that confidence. Yeah, she gave me grounding. My mother saw something special in me. And really, I'm the first person in my family to graduate from college. I went to an all-girls school, which I think also gave me tremendous confidence. I went to the Baldwin School for Girls in Bryn Mawr, but my mother saw something special in me, and she had me apply to Baldwin behind my father's back. And I think going to a girls' school also contributed to my confidence.
Okay, so you decide you're going to go into the music business. Where do you even start?
So I moved to New York. I live on your sister's couch. on 87th and 3rd until she left me there. And then I built a wall and I got a roommate. And I just started meeting people and really networking. And I knew I wanted a job in the music business. I thought I wanted a job at the time at MTV. There wasn't a job. And again, when I talk about being able to sell anything, I would go around to record companies. And at the time, it's funny, at the time, the jobs for women in record companies were in publicity or promotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be in publicity. And promotion just felt icky to me. Women going to radio stations and trying to get men to play the music. That didn't feel right to me. And one day, funny enough, Steve Backer, who was a friend of Wendy's, who helped Wendy, he was the head of the college division at CBS Records. And when Wendy graduated from Penn, she used to go to Steve's office with a bunch of people, and they would make calls from his office. So when I graduated from school, I used to go to Steve's office and make calls. And one day Steve said, my friend from camp, I just had lunch with my friend from camp, and he has a job opening at Chapel Music, go meet him. And I didn't know what Chapel Music was, but I went and I got a job. And I remember at the time they offered me $15,000 a year. And I said, well, what about 17? And they said, what about 16? And I said, okay, 16.5, living in New York City. And that's how I got my first job. And it was my first job at Chapel Music was I was the archivist. I Xeroxed lead sheets and lyric sheets for all of the old songwriters in New York. And I worked my way up from there, but I took an entry-level position within my Northwestern interview outfit, which quickly ended up in the back of my closet, never to be seen again. But what I learned at Chapel was that my real talent was knowing what would be a hit song. Because in those days at Chapel, it was about songwriters and song pluggers who placed a song with a recording artist. Imagine Whitney Houston is making an album. Clive Davis is looking for songs to fill that album. And my job, you know, really, I was an entry level as the archivist, and then the tape room job became available. And I combined both of those jobs, not with a raise, but I combined both of those jobs. And what I got out of that was I really listened to songs. I was able to identify the difference between a hit song and an okay song.
Okay, what is that difference?
It's just a thing.
Can you describe it or you just feel it?
I think we all feel it in a way. I just feel it earlier than you would. Like when you think about, you said in my intro, songs are the soundtrack of our lives. What was it about a song that you remembered the song that you fell in love with your partner with? You remember the song that was the big high school prom song. You remember certain songs and they become the soundtrack. I think simply it's about hearing a song and remembering it, remembering where you were when you first heard it. To me, I listen to songs and I listen to melody first. Can I hum that melody? And if I can, then I'll listen to the lyric. And I think the combination between a profound lyric and a great melody is what makes a hit song.
Mm-hmm. And so that radar you have for that, mm-hmm. would you say that's the most critical thing you've had to propel you in this business?
Yes. I think my ability to understand popular culture, my ability to understand artists and to respect their process and their art is really first and foremost the thing that I want to be remembered by. I've signed amazing songwriters and amazing artists, but I think the through line is that they make great music and that I was right. I made the right bet. When I signed Alicia Keys, it was different from when I signed Lady Gaga, and it was different from when I signed Harry Styles, and different from when I signed Lana Del Rey or SZA. But the through line is they have great music, but when you get to know an artist, they have to be the driver. My job is to support great talent. That's my job. Anytime I've signed an artist where I had more ambition for them than they had for themselves, it doesn't work. It's not just talent. So the first step is identifying that somebody can write great songs in for my job. But the next thing is getting to know them and getting to know where they want to go in their career and how we can support them. And that's really what it comes down to. And I think Alicia Keys was 14 when I signed her, but she was so talented. I remember thinking, my God, there's an old jazz singer in your body. There was something you've lived before, because how can you create what you're creating at 14 and 15? And we brought her out to LA for a writing trip for the first time. Lady Gaga told me she was going to be the biggest artist in the world. And it wasn't going to be about money. It was going to be about fame and art. So everybody's a little different, but the through line is that they're great songwriters and that they want to work really hard because they're ambitious. And I'm good at identifying that and knowing what to do with it.
Okay, so a lot of the names you said, not only are they great songwriters and great musicians, but they're extraordinary performers, which is a different thing also.
Yes, absolutely.
Can you make a great songwriter, singer, musician into a great performer or no?
I think there's a difference between people whose careers are as songwriters and producers behind the scenes and people who are great entertainers. There's a difference. And I think it has to be innate. I signed an artist named Rosalia from Spain. And when I met her, I just knew. And she's probably one of the greatest entertainers today. Her performance is amazing. But she studies dance and she studies playing the piano and she studies voice and she works so hard and has tremendous discipline. So I think it's not, I think they can get better, but I think, why does Justin Bieber need to be famous? It's always fascinating to me. I didn't grow up needing to be famous. I didn't need to be famous. I get nervous. I mean, I can speak publicly, but I couldn't sing and dance publicly. But what is that thing? And it's a difference between great artists and me. And I love it. I love it. I'm just so fascinated and respect people's differences. And, you know, why can certain people get on a stage and love, you know, look at Taylor Swift. She can get on stage and stand there with her arms wide, taking in all of the applause. I'd be covering up my chest and fiddling and no, not me. Why? Like, what is that? And I think it's fascinating.
It's their energy. It's their oxygen, I guess.
It's their oxygen. It's their oxygen. And I love it. I absolutely love it.
Seeing an extraordinary entertainer is just elevating. It's not quite the word.
I think it is elevating. I do think it's elevating. I think that there's nothing like it. And it's thrilling. And I think that hearing music through your computer and watching TikTok or YouTube Shorts or any of that is fine. It's a taste. But going to a live event, people didn't know during the pandemic that live music would come back as strong as it did. People want to experience live music together. It's phenomenal and it's a great feeling and it's a great communal feeling that I think unifies us rather than dividing us around the world. And we're so divided that I like to believe that music is the unifier.
I think so. You do feel sort of a kinship with everyone around you in that section, whatever you're
in. Yes.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
And we're back with Jody Gerson, CEO of Universal Music Publishing Group. Let's talk about your career trajectory for a little bit. So you started out sort of doing whatever you could and were sort of making your way to the part of the music business that you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you had a very good career, but ultimately you hit a roadblock.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about that part of your career and what did you do?
So I think I tell the story differently years later than I did then.
That's interesting.
So I worked for Marty Bandier pretty much the entirety of my career up until I was 50. And first at EMI and then at Sony. And I learned everything that I know about being a music publisher from Marty. And he gave me a tremendous amount. But I got divorced right before my 50th birthday. And my contract was up. And Michael Linton was running Sony at the time. And Michael asked me to speak at an investor conference. And when I think about it, it was probably that Amy Pascal was the head of the studio. And it was the head of the studio, head of television, head of international, head of the record company, head of publishing company. And I think they probably needed another woman. So I agreed to speak and Michael gave me media training and I spoke at the conference and it changed everything for me. It was life-changing for me.
In terms of how you felt about things or people knowing you?
It gave me confidence. I could do it. I could deliver to an investment community. It was like around the time of Dan Loeb was creating, whatever
right.
It was creating noise. And I did it and I delivered.
It's so funny to me that you were shocked by that.
I was never put in that position to do it. I was not in that position. And I also, Karen, I gave a commencement speech at Baldwin and I talked about thinking my whole life that it was about loyalty and being a good girl was going to get me that big job and that promotion. And so making my boss look good and doing all the right things was going to get me there. And so here's what happened. I spoke at that investor conference. I developed a newfound confidence that was just bigger. I was getting divorced and I found my power. I realized that path of being the good girl, being the good wife, doing all those things, I had to change. And I found a new sense. So my deal was coming up and I asked Marty if I would be his successor when he stepped down. And he said no. And the reason why I say I tell the story differently now is that it wasn't personal. It was more about him not being done. And what it did for me, the way I interpret it was, well, wait a second. This is the message. I need to leave. And I went out and Lucian Grange offered me the job as chairman of Universal. And I think that in that process, all of the questions and insecurities I had, like, how am I going to do this with three children at home and being, you know, somewhat of a single mom? How am I going to do this if I fully don't, you know, I came from A&R, which is the creative part of the business. What if I don't understand how royalties are set up in India or China or Africa or Germany? What will I do? And I forced myself through the insecurity, the stuff that I had believed my whole career, which was don't make waves, make sure the man is stronger than you, make him prop him up, that it was my time. And I took the job feeling those insecurities, but feeling a greater sense of responsibility for other women in the business. My whole career, I was like, wait a second, I'm better than that guy. Why did he get that job? And people used to say all the time, Karen, she's not leaving him, including Lucian. She's not leaving him. She's so loyal to him.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was true for a really long time.
Well, I mean, that is such a great point that you bring up. And there's something that men do we used to have guys come on our show and they would just pound the table. The market's going to do this or that. And I would think, wow, he really does know. And then it occurred to me, nobody knows. But that's he just acts like he does. And then I realized, you know what? That's not so dumb.
No, it's not.
And we don't want to do that. Women don't want to do that. And it's really to our disservice.
It is to our disservice. And many of us, like, I didn't have an example in my mom. My mom did other amazing things. But my mother was a good wife and a good mother. How would I have modeled any other behavior in a corporate environment? I didn't know from it. And also at the time, there weren't women who helped me. And so I think I left because I had to. I left Sony. I gave notice. I had 4 months. And in those 4 months, I'd been single for 2.5 years. I met Gavin Pallone, who I know you know. And there was something else that I was open to that I was never open to before or that I had never experienced, which was a partner who pushes me, who says, wait a second, you don't need to be emotional about that. You don't need to apologize for that. You have what it takes. And so I think he gave me even more confidence and ability. Now, I came to Universal. The company was a little less than $800 million in revenue. And 9 years later, it's in excess of $2 billion in revenue. So I know what I'm doing. And I think that all of the things that led me here in terms of management style, I think the key to my success is not just my ability to spot talent. That's part of it. And to make people believe I know what to do with their careers. It's that I very strategically put together an incredible management team of people who I believe in, who I trust. I don't micromanage. I don't have an excessive amount of direct reports. I'm running a global business. I am in charge of China. I am in charge of India. And the way to manage it is to have people around me who I really trust, who are experts. And I think that what I've learned is that I can take in information from other people and I'm decisive. I make really good decisions. So I think the other big thing that I'm really proud of is that I run a business with real integrity. Our systems, our royalty systems around the world are transparent. When I first came to the company, they had the ability to be transparent. You hear so much stuff about the music business not being a transparent business. Ours is transparent. And when I came to the company, already had integrity. It just didn't have a winning mindset. It just wasn't a winning company. It was ranked fourth, sometimes third, sometimes fourth among the majors. And I really had to kind of, you know, give the company around the world a pep talk. I like being number one. That was my goal of being number one in market share, number one in revenue. And we'll be there. We will be there in time. And it's because we were very strategic in not only signing artists, but also signing film companies. We administer Warner Brothers Pictures and television. We administer Universal Television and NBC. So it's not just artists, it's great companies who have amazing music catalogs. So, you know, I'm really proud of that.
So you've talked a lot in the past about hiring great people. Mm-hmm. What is it that you look for in the business people? And what do you look for in those who are signing talent?
So different skill sets, but I think it's about hiring people you can trust, hiring people who are good communicators, and making sure they believe that I'm invested in their success. I will never hold anybody back, ever. I will never do that. And I've also created a community at the company of people who want to see each other succeed. I don't adhere to the management style of pitting people against each other, which is very popular in my business and in other businesses. In terms of A&R people, it's the more success you've had, the more confidence I have in supporting who people want to sign. You know, but things are different. When I first got into music publishing or into the music business, you sign people based truly on gut. Now you have data that shows you if they're really having success. And so I still, you know, a lot of people during the pandemic were signing artists based on their followership on YouTube or on Instagram or on TikTok. And they lost a lot because what those platforms don't inform you of is that person a star. Is that person a star or are they an influencer? And there's a difference.
And so you also, I know, have really been a champion for women.
Yes. Look, I run a meritocracy at the company and the best person gets the job. That being said, during the Me Too movement and Time's Up, I think it's very important that men change, but that also women change. And I felt at that time that neither one of those movements spoke as much to the music business. Women who want to be in music want to be in the music business. And for many years tolerated a lot of bad behavior because they wanted to be in the music business. Did they get a seat at the table? I can't tell you that I feel we've come as far as we need to come, but Alicia Keys and I were having a conversation around that time, and we decided to create She Is the Music with a very simple mission. It's about increasing the number of working women in music. It's not about putting down men. It's not about reducing the amount of men in the workforce or reducing the amount of men in songwriting. It's about lifting women. And I believe that women will not have the kind of success we want to have in business unless we support each other. So my solution is creating sisterhood and communities of women who support each other and who push each other into position. And when they're feeling like, oh my God, can I do that job? We come together and we say, you absolutely can do that job. Mm-hmm. And here's how you're going to do it because we're going to help you.
Well, also there's the be the change you want to see in the world. You are that change. There was no Jody Gerson when you first joined the business.
And I mean, you know, Karen, my kids say to me, oh, I would never wait until I was 50 to have that chance. I didn't make real money until my mid-50s. I just didn't. The circumstances were different for me, but I also am accountable for that. And so for me, I can run a business, but now I have to really pay attention to my own finances, which are very different than they were pre-50.
So a lot of change.
A lot of change for the good. And I tell those stories because I think it's important for other women to hear authentic stories about each other, because I think our stories are all very similar.
They are very similar. There's always a circuitous path somewhat, but perseverance and moving backwards before moving up. But it's always great to see someone who did it. So it's not, I mean, we always talk about the glass ceiling. You really did break the glass ceiling in an industry that had a very, very thick glass ceiling.
No question. And the other thing is, I took this job as me. I didn't take this job as any of the men who I worked for before. I took it as me. And I care that every woman and man who works at the company has the same benefit of me in terms of being able to go watch a dance recital or a sports event. I think the pandemic changed that certainly about how people work. But even before that, I thought it was important that people find the right balance in their lives. And we devote so much to our jobs, and I'm very much defined by this job. But at the same time, everybody else should have the same ability as I do to be with your family when you need to be with your family. And I think I came into this role conscious of that and not hiding that I have 3 kids and not hiding that I'm in a bad mood when one of my kids is hurting, you know?
Or in trouble or did something stupid.
Exactly.
Just speaking of my own kids, yes.
And I think it's important that when women run companies, I think we change the way companies operate. I really
do.
Do, and it's a different management style. And I just think there need to be more of us.
For sure. For sure. All right. We're going to have to take a quick break and we're going to come back with the lightning round.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, here we go. Lightning round. It's just would you rather, couple of questions, but mostly would you rather this or that. Okay, would you rather travel back in time or into the future?
Into the future.
Classical or heavy metal?
Classical.
Pop or rap?
Pop.
Country or techno?
Country.
Grammys or Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Why?
Because I think it's important to pay homage to the past.
Ah, okay. Excellent answer. Jeans or black tie?
Jeans.
Okay. Would you rather watch a 6-part series or a feature film?
Lately, 6-part series.
Okay. Would you rather help a woman attend college or help a woman get a job?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think attend college.
Really?
I do.
Okay.
I think education is the key to our future and that not enough people are able to have a good education.
Okay. Good answer. Okay. Would you rather laugh uncontrollably or be moved?
I'm often moved, but I would rather laugh uncontrollably.
Me too. Fiction or nonfiction?
Fiction.
What is something you've changed your mind about in the last year?
Oh, I've changed my mind about so much. I feel like I've changed my mind about being not afraid of what the future holds.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that is a great answer. Okay.
I'm trying not to be afraid.
Okay. All right. How did you do that?
I'm trying to be present. And I'm trying not to be anxious. And I'm trying to be hopeful that democracy will prevail. And I'm just trying to be hopeful because what's the sense of anticipating and having horrible anxiety about the future?
When you can't control
maybe good
a
will
lot
happen
of
it. If you can't control right. it. I'm really, really trying to give up the things I can't control.
All right. So just what would be the advice you would have to young women looking to start a career in music?
Find a network of other women who will support you, who will open doors for you, and who will encourage you.
Okay. Excellent. All right. Where can our listeners find you?
They can find me through UMPG's Instagram.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much, Jody. Thank you.
I'm really thrilled that you asked me to do this.
Thank you so much for joining me today on How She Does It. And thank you so much to Judy Gerson for sharing her life in the music industry. When you have a moment, please follow us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to updates from the Her Money community at hermoney.com/subscribe. Our producers are Catherine Tuggle and Haley Pascalides with help from everyone at Her Money. This podcast is mixed and mastered out of CDM Sound Studios. Our music is from Video Helper and our show comes to you through Megaphone. Have a great week, and I look forward to seeing you here with us again. Onward.